Hello and welcome back to the Public Lands Podcast. Following on the heels of last week's fascinating interview with Shelley Silbert, Executive Director of Great Old Broads for Wilderness, talking about privatization of BLM lands, today I'm very pleased to bring you a conversation with Dr. Jeff Todd Titan. Jeff Todd Titan is a Professor Emeritus of Music at Brown University. After earning his BA in 1965 from Amherst College, he ventured way out here to the University of Minnesota, where he completed his MA in English and a PhD in American Studies. He taught American literature, folklore, and ethnomusicology at Tufts from 1971 through 1986, co-founding that university's American Studies program and MA in ethnomusicology. Jeff went on to teach at Brown University from 1986 on through to 2013 when he became Professor Emeritus. Those of you who know Jeff, however, know that he did not retire so much as use that opportunity to do even more research, taking on speaking engagements around the country, and serving in residence at several universities. One of my favorite interactions with Jeff was when he was serving in that role on the beautiful campus of East Tennessee State University and hosted a campus-wide forum on the topic of music and the environment. At Brown, Dr. Titan was the director of the PhD program in ethnomusicology. His books include Early Down-Home Blues, A Musical and Cultural Analysis, and Powerhouse for God, Speech, Chant, and Song in an Appalachian Baptist Church. Is co-editor of the Oxford Handbook of Applied Ethnomusicology and general editor of Worlds of Music, an introduction to the music of the world's peoples. You'll have a hard time finding an ethnomusicology student or faculty member that at some time didn't read and take that book as part of their education. He was editor of Ethnomusicology, the Journal of the Society for Ethnomusicology, from 1990 to 1995. In 1998, he was elected a Fellow of the American Folklore Society. In 2015, his field recordings were chosen for preservation in the National Recording Registry, Library of Congress. That's an incredibly rare accomplishment that puts him in the company of some of the nation's most celebrated recording artists. Consider the 2018 recordings given that status, a distinguished pantheon that includes recordings by Cab Calloway. I'm looking down the list here. Richie Valens, Benjamin Britten, Nina Simone, Robert F. Kennedy, Neil Diamond's Sweet Caroline, Earth, Wind, and Fire's September, and Jay-Z's The Blueprint album. Yet, if you met Jeff on the street and struck up a conversation with him, you might think that you're just talking to a fellow fan of blues and old-time music. He is that, of course. And an accomplished strings player. But you get the point here that Dr. Titan has been a titan in the world of ethnomusicology and environmental studies as well. More specifically, in regard to public lands and environment, Jeff's publications concerning music and environment and soundscape, including his writings on the topic of Henry David Thoreau, work to help organize scholars across disciplines and professions in a transdisciplinary field or conversation that has tended to take on the title ecomusicology in the past 15 years or so, and his very popular blog, Sustainable Music, has reinvigorated interdisciplinary research around sound and environment. Today, I specifically wanted to talk to Jeff about a concept that he's been discussing for some time now, the sound commons. A perspective on sound and public space, including publicly owned lands and waters, that is underemphasized as we think about public lands stewardship. Hello, Jeff. Welcome to the Public Lands Podcast, and thanks for sharing your time and ideas with us today.
Well, you're more than welcome, and I'm happy to be here, Mark. I'm anxious to talk to you.
As I noted in the introduction, and as an ethnomusicologist, the field research you have conducted throughout your career has been very place-based. Like R. Murray Schafer and other acoustic ecologists, your musical research has connected sound to soundscape. However, you've developed a concept, the sound commons, that frames public sound and soundscape in a very distinct way. What is the sound commons?
Well, first of all, We need to know what a commons is, and a commons is something that is shared rather than owned. And so a sound commons is a landscape that's shared, not owned. Sound in a soundscape that's sound commons is freely shared by all the creatures that are in that place. And that includes not only human creatures, but also animals and plants and any other beings that people might think were there or other beings might think were there. And sharing a sound commons means that all the creatures are able to communicate in that sounding landscape or soundscape in their acoustic places or acoustic niches, to be technical about it, without any interference or with as little interference as possible. And to do that, the creatures that inhabit those places, they adjust the timing of their sound communications. They adjust the melodies and the rhythms and the frequencies and when they do it, when they're silent, so that the other sounds don't block them out or block them out as little as possible. You take, for instance, a chainsaw that goes into a person with a chainsaw working in a forest is going to interfere with many of the creatures that are in there. And so when that chainsaw goes, the creatures tend to be silent. But when it stops, then they resume their sound communication.
Well, that's really interesting. You know, I want to ask you how you came up with the concept and why you feel it's important. But as you said that, it made me think of a place that I lived for a while on Orcas Island. I no longer live there, but where I would notice, you know, neighbors, even though we were fairly distant apart, not only chainsaws, blowers, that kind of thing, but even dogs, you know, barking would just completely change the soundscape. You'd suddenly hear the frogs would go silent. And I think so many things that are human cause noise, as Gordon Hempton's pointing out, that far exceed most natural sounds, or at least most biological natural sounds. So how did you come up with this concept, and why do you feel it's important?
Well, I don't know, as somebody who lived through the 60s and was involved in the various social and political movements, the idea of sharing always appealed to me. And when I read about the commons and the agricultural commons in Europe and how the peasants all shared the land and so on, that appealed to me and it stuck with me. And then I also read Garrett Hardin's article about the so-called tragedy of the commons, in which the peasants supposedly exploited the commons for personal gain and exhausted its resources. That actually never happened with the agricultural commons, or very seldom happened, because it was regulated to some extent. But the idea of tragedy of the commons took hold back in the late 60s and early 70s when I was thinking about commons, and it intrigued me to try to find counterexamples to that. Anyway, the idea of a sound commons didn't come until some decades later. In the 1990s, I was listening to birds. I got very interested in birdsong, and I went out on my walks and would listen to the birds. And of course, I noticed that there are many different birds that were singing. But they weren't exactly all singing at the same time. Some of them were some of the times, but I gradually began to realize that they adjusted their singing so that it didn't interfere with others. Even in the dawn chorus, when I woke up in the morning, I could tell that there were some adjustments. And at about the same time, I had been reading in Henry David Thoreau's journals. And although he didn't speak of sound commons, he was familiar with agricultural commons, and yet he was very, very attentive to the sounds of birds and frogs and crickets. He called it all the earth song. And so all of this was kind of on my mind, and then I just kind of put two and two together, and the idea of the sound commons just kind of popped out.
Yeah, that, you know, and I think it's a really valuable concept. And as you mentioned, you know, your undergraduate and graduate training, and then your early experience in the 60s and 70s. I think back and my experience in the late 70s, actually early 80s as an undergraduate student, is reading things like The Tragedy of the Commons, but also Limits to Growth, that, you know, major study that came out. And it almost strikes me that this is one of those, when you mention those acoustic niches, et cetera, where we hit limits. There's only so much that can go into a sound space before at least a lot of the biodiversity is crowded out. So I think it's just a really valuable concept. You know, before I want to ask you the question, I'm going to ask you the question sort of maybe how this has been instantiated at least a little bit to give us those glimmers of hopes of where it's happening. But maybe before I do that, can you think of any ways in which we maybe try to instantiate, like measure it or find a way to say, hey, this sound commons might be better than another one? Is there any way to sort of identify what a good sound commons is?
Well, there's some folks who have really done research on soundscape. The person who comes to mind first is Bernie Krause, who wrote a book back in the 90s, although I wasn't aware of it until this century, called Wild Soundscapes. And he's done some recording. He's gone to places where human beings haven't much been, and made recordings of the various sounds in those places. And he's more or less said that he feels that the health of a place can be measured by the soundscape. The louder the soundscape, the healthier is the landscape that's there. But as you say, up to a certain limit, because of the possibility of interference. He's gone back to some of the same places 20 years later, 30 years later, and recorded the sounds and found that really they were much less diverse and also overall softer. And so he feels that this is an example of the degradation of the environment that has happened, that it's less healthy. So sound is kind of a measure of the health of the landscape, you might say. But as far as the actual examples of terrible sound interference, the ones that I think come to people's mind first are the oceans, with the noise from ship propellers and from naval sonar and so on, that are interfering with the communications among whales and other sea creatures. That's something that environmentalists have studied and measured with microphones that they put down into the ocean. They call it hydrophones. It's my ambition sometime to do that. I've never recorded anything in the ocean. Actually, oceans are pretty much terra incognita to me, but someday I hope to do that. But anyway, that's a good example of a kind of degraded soundscape in some areas, and folks have done some research. And then, of course, there have been attempts to limit the ocean noise from the ships, and they've been successful in some areas and not so successful in others.
Well, that's a good point. And your description talking about Bernie Krause's work, et cetera, really reminds me of in Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. She talks about how the Silent Spring really isn't so silent, but we get used to the, she has just a poetic way of saying it, so I'll paraphrase here, but the kind of incessant noise of motors, the numbing hymn, you know, of the motor. So it's really not quiet so much as it is just overwhelming. By the way, as you mentioned, the sort of experiments in the water. I'd really love it if you come out to Orcas Island at some point. I have had an experiment in the water where I run a 4-horsepower motor and I'm replacing it with a frequency generator. And I just did the finally had the data fully coded in from the sonar and found out that the before condition of 5 minutes, there were a great deal more fish, forage fish, than during the motor. And then after condition actually was the least. So there's this sort of slow, as you imagine those otoliths banging in the fish, that they, this sort of slow reaction to that sound where they really do are displaced from the territory. And I've really been impressed by people doing the more important work around marine mammals. But as kind of an amateur, it's been fun just putting the hydrophone down and seeing what happens with some sonar. So if you want to get involved in that, I'd love to bring you out and talk to the people at Friday Harbor Labs and that are doing some of that work.
I'd like to do that someday. That would be a lot of fun and quite interesting, I think, for me to do.
Yeah, and I think you'd have probably some insights on it that as you get into the research, you start forgetting all the things you're not thinking about, and I've become so focused on very specific aspects of displacement that probably could use some fresh eyes on it. And speaking of fresh eyes, this podcast is about stewardship of public lands, water, and air, and it's really transitioning to the point where it's mainly student-generated content, and right now I'm training a new group into that, and so your podcast is one that will really help out as they're figuring out how to do their own projects. But despite being a music researcher myself, like you, although I by no means have I done the depth and prestigious work you've done, as an anthropologist, I've really came into it fairly late, around the turn of the millennium. But you know, I'm ashamed to admit that I was planning this podcast and I realized how little it's dealt with soundscape issues, even though it's my main thing. You know, clearly our public parks, wilderness areas, refuges, national and state forests, and even public managed Superfund sites are really an integral part of our sound commons, as you put it. Yet, as you pointed out, and sound advocates like Gordon Hempton or Bernie Krause, who you mentioned, have argued, sound is often one of the last matters that stewards of public lands actually attend to. I know that you've worked with Scott McFarland and the Natural Sounds Night Skies Division of the National Park Service, for example. What are some of those examples where the sound commons concept has been put into practice in order to create a more pleasurable, healthy, sustainable, and biodiverse sound commons? And here I'm kind of looking for hope that maybe this idea has been instantiated in a way that we can point to and say, hey, we need more of that.
Well, we do need more of that, and folks like Scott understand it. It's not been funded as well as it should be, and so that work is really kind of incomplete. Let me back up a little bit and say a little about how that all got started. It wasn't started because folks that worked for the park said, hey, we've got to do something about the natural sounds in this park in order to promote biodiversity. Instead, it arose from complaints by visitors that they went to the park for a kind of wilderness experience, but they were hearing the noise from helicopter tours and motorcycles on the roads, and this was all interfering with their sound commons, with their wilderness experience. And so the park people began to say, well, maybe what we need to do is to try to figure out ways in which to understand what the natural sounds in the park are that folks come out here in order to experience, and then try to promote those and to discourage the noise that interferes with it from motorcycles and helicopter tours and other kinds of things. It was quite interesting. I went early one morning out in the National Park, the Great Smoky National Park, and there's a place called a Quiet Walk. You go off the road into this area that was supposed to be a quiet walk, but it wasn't quiet. There weren't any helicopter tours, but I sure could hear the motorcycles going, and there was road construction going on. And, And sure enough, I experienced exactly what those complaining visitors had complained. So my work with Scott, who works for the parks and is a biologist who works in the Natural Sounds and Night Skies division, involved really trying to figure out what it was that he was up to. And at that stage, what he was doing was experimenting and trying to monitor the sounds that were out there in the park. And this is something that might appeal to some of your students if they haven't done this already, and that is to leave recording devices. It could be something like a smartphone or something more sophisticated than that, out in a wilderness area in the park, and just set the recorder on, the recording app on, and have it monitor the sounds in that area for as long as the phone would run before the battery would run out, and then listen back to it and see what creatures were there. Scott had a much more sophisticated series of recorders that he put out there. And at first, incidentally, they were all destroyed by the bears. And so he had to protect the recorders by putting them in special boxes so that the bears wouldn't play football with them or whatever they wanted to do. But in any case, he was in the monitoring stage. He was still trying to figure out what the sounds were that were there out there. And of course, he also monitored the interference sounds from the noise of construction or automobiles or helicopter tours, which were still going on. But the plan is to route the helicopters differently and to cut down on the tours and to be sensitive to the construction sounds and so on and so forth. So it's interesting that it was, to me at any rate, that it was not driven by and environmentalism so much as it was driven by complaints from the tourists. But that gave an opportunity for the biologists, who of course were interested in the environmental aspects of it, to begin to do their work.
Oh yeah, that's a really good point, and maybe even shouting out to the Colorado State University Sound Lab that works with Scott, because that study of the national parks, hopefully in terms of policy, is going to really make a change. So what are some of those changes? What could institutions, or for that matter, even individuals and communities, do in order to improve our sound commons? What sort of things might we do?
Well, you know, we have planners, right? architects and planners that cities have professional planners who plan for downtown spaces and so forth. And in some areas, they're sensitive to the acoustics. I was out in Portland, Oregon, and spoke with a few people who were quite interested in what I might have to say to them about the sounds of the downtown areas in Portland and how to make it less noisy, I guess, basically, is what they wanted. It wasn't like it was a concert hall and they were going to try to improve the acoustics. But they were quite interested in this, and I thought this was a pretty good sign. Of course, Portland is a very green city, but many of your towns, most of your towns have noise ordinances, and folks, of course, are sensitive to loud noises. You don't want to live next to a stone quarry, for example, where they're cutting stone all the time. And some folks get really bothered by sounds of the city, like police sirens, or if you live across from a firehouse, you're always hearing the fire engines going out, and their fire sirens are going, and so on and so forth. So folks become aware of this sort of thing, and planners can and do try to factor these kinds of things in. But it's kind of hard, I think, to get folks to understand the importance of a soundscape when they do the planning. And so kind of raising consciousness, I think, in this area would be very helpful. You could start, folks could start by just inventorying the sounds that they hear in their particular areas and then go down to when it come time to speak at a town government or city government or something, raise the issue of sound and what might possibly could be done about it. You know, we have, I can remember when I was a boy, it was something, if you had an automobile, if you could own an automobile, and not too many of us did, but a few did, it was important to have a muffler that was as loud as possible, a glass-packed muffler or something like that. You might remember that sort of thing too. Mm-hmm. And of course, this was a very powerful sound, kind of like a powerful bird song saying, "Here I am, I'm the strongest, biggest, baddest," you know. and so on. But the rest of the folks listening to that cover their ears. We might want to do some things against sound aggression. But there's also, besides the trying to help our own ears, the ears of all of the creatures that are in a particular place deserve respect. And as you were mentioning, the biodiversity of the area is terribly dependent upon communication among creatures. If the animals can't communicate with each other in a given place, they can't stay there. And so they have to leave. And if they do have to stay there, they can't live there. And so they'll their population will decrease in that particular area.
Oh, that's really well put, and it almost sounds like a staged process where I'm thinking of our mutual friend Denise von Glahn and the idea of skillful listening as she articulates it, that first becoming aware of what sounds are there and then doing something about it, recognizing that there's policies and procedures out there for people to participate in changing a soundscape. And I'm thinking back to, as you mentioned that, the way in which we get inured to sound. I have this experience where I'm in a very quiet cabin in the middle of nowhere for a part of the year, small part of the year. And then most of the year I'm here in the middle of a city where I literally live by a metal producing plant where they bend metals into various ways, and it's extremely loud. And I remember when you visited, you were in Maine at the time and then came out here, and how you just noticed every sound and how a restaurant seemed loud to you. And it really reminded me again how quickly a person can become used to the din and forget how big a problem this really is. So I really hope that people listen to what you're saying, and maybe the students that are listening to this can think about possibly doing their projects this semester around issues of sound, because it's so important. And as you mentioned earlier, it's a great cipher for other issues that are going on, that sound becomes a real indicator of the biodiversity and health of a soundscape.
Absolutely. And students could start by just having like a sound notebook in which they jot down the sounds that they hear in a given day. If they live with other people, they have to negotiate the sounds in their own soundscape. Somebody's playing used to be playing the stereo too loud. I guess now everybody's got their headphones on or something. But in any case, there's still a bunch of sounds around, and students could just write down the sounds that they hear and their impressions, what they like, what they don't like, what they wish they could hear better, what they wish they could hear less. And that way they would become aware of those sounds that we normally block out because we become inured to them. We don't want to hear them particularly. We don't want to listen to the noise of the metal factory that's nearby. And so we have that capability of blocking it out. But if you wanted to talk to somebody over that, the loud sound, say, of a metal factory, you'd have to shout, or you might even not be able to communicate at all. And that's the problem with having so much interference and not having a sound commons where folks can freely communicate and other creatures can freely communicate as well.
You know, good points. And I really hope that the concept of the sound commons continues to get more leverage, because I think it's not only an important academic concept for understanding of it, but also one of those that in terms of application and meaningful change in the world could really make a difference. So thanks so much for sharing your ideas with us today, Jeff, and taking your time to be on the podcast.
Well, it's my pleasure, and thanks for having me, Mark.
All right, you take care.
You too.